This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, June 9th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting, which is more than just media sound bites. My guest today is J. Bruce Campbell. His website is jbcampbellextremismonline.com. And you have a lot of very, very interesting topics that you cover on your website. But you also were on Press TV yesterday talking about the subject that nobody seems to want to talk about in the mainstream media. In fact, they don't just not seem to. They simply ignore the entire thing. The government lied then. The Israeli government lied, saying that, it was mistaken identity. And, of course, they've been concealing it ever since. And some of the top concealers would include the McCain family. So, Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Deanna.
All righty. So tell us a little bit about this interview that you did yesterday on Press TV. I did listen to it this morning and found it very interesting.
Well, a lady called from Press TV in Tehran, gave me about 4 hours notice and said, we'd like to have you on. Is there a studio nearby? I said, no, I live in Idaho. You know, there's no studio around here. Oh, well, let's do it by Skype. So, fine. I had to hold a phone up to my ear for some reason and instead of using the Skype audio. But I was on with Michael Santomaro and Allison Weir, and it was a three-way deal. The moderator asked us to comment on the attack on the Liberty. Yesterday was the 45th anniversary. So Santomaro went first, Allison Weir second, and I got to come and, you know, hit cleanup. But the point is that there was something in those days called Operation Cyanide, which you know about, but most people don't know about it because it's probably the most toxic secret in America. Because Operation Cyanide was the code name for a super secret operation to send the USS Liberty to Gaza, Sinai area, and to patrol very closely to the coastline and monitor radios during the Six-Day War. They got there on the night of June 7th and started patrolling immediately in a dogleg pattern along the coast. And immediately at daylight, Israeli observation planes were going overhead, some of them being getting very close to the ship, but the men were confident that Israel was an ally, and so they weren't on guard at all. In fact, they were sunbathing on the deck, many of them, and the captain, McGonigal, even encouraged that to make them look non-threatening to the Israelis. And then about after 4 hours of observations, of close observations, the attack started. And it was unbelievable, according to the men. It just came from all directions at once, and they hit them with everything they had. And they were using unmarked French Mystère and Mirage fighters. And they could kind of recognize the airplanes. But they couldn't put it together. They had no idea who was flying these airplanes. They thought it was the Russians at first. They thought because the Soviet Union was a sponsor of the Egyptians, and they assumed it was the Egyptians attacking them. But they never dreamed it would be the Israelis, which was the whole idea. So Operation Cyanide was this diabolical, treacherous, even unspeakable plan to send this most sophisticated ship in the U.S. Navy, which was actually under the control of the NSA, to be sunk by the Israelis and blamed on Egypt, which the second part of the operation was to, in a feigned outrage, to bomb Cairo and Alexandria with nuclear weapons. And the airplanes carrying these nuclear weapons were actually launched from the USS America, hundreds of miles away up in, I think, the Aegean. They were on, the fleet was on maneuvers at this time, and the Liberty was sent down to the war zone in a shooting war with no protection. There was apparently one or maybe two U.S. submarines observing this diabolical trick. But anyway, the bombing planes were sent to bomb Cairo and Alexandria. The Israelis had been given radio frequencies, the secret radio frequencies that the Liberty used. Now, the Liberty was the most sophisticated ship in the world. It had many, many antennas for listening and for sending, transmitting. But one of the transmitting antennas was this, I forget the name of it, but it was this massive structure on towards the stern, and it had a big dish that was aimed at the moon, and it bounced its signals off the moon down to Cheltenham, Maryland, or wherever NSA headquarters is. So it was not capable of being intercepted. There was no way to intercept these signals from the ship to the NSA headquarters. The personnel on board were Navy, U.S. Navy, but all of the interception work, the intel, was done by the NSA civilian personnel on board. So
there is a document that talks about this, and it is from the NSA. It's the United States Cryptologic History. And it talks about the attack on the USS Liberty, and the document was released in April of 2011. And it seems that your other guest on Press TV simply knew nothing about Operation Cyanide. They knew nothing about the NSA. And in fact, Alison Ware talked about the book that James Ennis wrote as if that was the, you know, that he wrote The Assault on the Liberty in 1979, and basically he was part of the cover-up, correct?
Absolutely. He kicked me off the USS Liberty veterans group. I had been invited back in 95, to, because I'd written an article, and everybody on all the veterans kind of liked it. They were afraid at that point. They were still afraid to talk about it. I mean, the fear that was instilled in these guys by Admiral Kidd and the other brass under McCain was so intense that they were certain that they were going to be imprisoned or killed if they said a word about this attack. So that for 30 years, they never said a damn thing until Ennis's book came out. Then they kind of timidly started saying a few things, but they were just so terrorized. So Ennis, you know, was the officer of the deck, or officer of the day when the attack happened, and he was severely wounded. You know, it's a miracle that he survived. But he's like one of these Buckley conservatives. He wants to be a responsible sort of critic of Israel, not somebody who tells the absolute truth. He has to keep it under control. So he kicked me off the Liberty website back in 96, which he denies today. And Joe Meders did the same thing. They just said they had this monitor, a Jewish monitor, on the website named Dr. Friend, Bill Friend. You know, a friendly doctor,
right?
A friendly Jewish doctor. And he was a smarmy, sanctimonious character who said, "Oh, you wonderful guys, we just would hate that you would think that this was done on purpose. This was a dreadful, dreadful accident." So I got on the website and I said, "What the hell are you talking about? What are you doing on here?" What's a Jewish doctor, if you are, if that's your real name, what are you doing here, controlling this whole thing? They even went, they had, annual dinners of the veterans and the survivors, and they would have Jews sitting at all the tables with these guys, monitoring them and making sure that they loved Israel and they knew Israel made a terrible mistake. Oh, boy. So they were, these guys were just hammered for decades. And a few of them are coming out now and saying, yeah, Israel did it on purpose. Yeah, big deal. But America did it on purpose. This is the whole deal. It was done by the United States government to get you guys all killed to justify nuking Egypt and starting Eretz Israel, from the Nile to the Euphrates. That's what it was all about. And people just don't realize what a horrible catastrophe this was for the Israelis and the American Jews who designed this vicious plot. They invested everything in this. It was a dead cert job, and somehow the Israelis managed to screw it up. They hit them with everything, but they weren't able to sink this old tub. It's just a miracle in many ways. There are many, many miracles involved that day.
Oh, I agree with you completely. And it was, as you say, it was a flubbed up false flag attack. And because of the miracles, that ship should have actually sunk to the bottom with all of the holes. I mean, weren't there like 800 holes? I think they stopped counting at 802 or something.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. They hit it with cannon fire. They hit it with machine guns. They hit it with rockets. They hit it with napalm. Then when all that failed, and they did put all those holes in it, but when that failed, then the motor torpedo boats came out from Ashdod or wherever, three of them with two torpedoes each. They fired all six at the ship, and somehow only one hit it. But that one put a massive 40-foot hole at the waterline and should have sunk it. I mean, nobody understands why it didn't sink. And it killed 25 guys with that one torpedo. So,
right.
God. And then, after it didn't sink, Johnson ordered it to go to Malta, days and days away, hoping that it would sink en route, because they had to sink the stupid thing and keep it secret until they could blame Egypt for it. But it wouldn't sink. So then the cover-up, the heavy, heavy cover-up started. Admiral Kidd, Isaac Kidd, working for McCain, intercepted the ship en route to Malta, came aboard, asked McGonagall, is this thing seaworthy? And McGonagall said, it looks as if it is. So I'm going to have a court of inquiry right now. Yes, sir. So he starts interviewing these guys, and he takes off his stars, off his collar, and said, okay, boys, just look at me as another sailor. Tell me what happened. In your own words. So they started telling their horrible stories, machine gunning life rafts in the water, and just endless atrocities and war crimes against their so-called ally. And he said, okay. And he put his stars back. I'm Admiral Kidd again. Now, you boys will never say a word about this to yourselves, to your families. If you do, I will send you to the brig. And or worse. And these guys were shocked from the attack, and then they were just shocked senseless by this vicious bastard, Isaac Kidd, threatening them for speaking about what happened.
Now, Isaac Kidd, Admiral Kidd, he first said that it was a case of mistaken identity because he was under the direct orders to do so by Defense Secretary McNamara and President Johnson. And then basically he went along with them. Correct?
Oh, sure. He was under orders from McCain, Admiral McCain, who was closely tied to Arthur Goldberg, the Supreme Court Justice, who had stepped down, and he was a United Nations ambassador and just an Israeli agent in the U.S. government.
So, and he's the father of Senator John McCain. And he wasn't he sent to London to be in charge of this operation?
Well, he was in charge of the cover-up, the court of inquiry, which lasted a few days. And he said that, you know, it was a dreadful accident. And then a kid went along with that. Those were orders. And even that other Captain Ward Boston, he admitted that he went along with it, too. He said, I'm a sailor. I follow orders. Well, yeah, right. You guys all do. Then when they retire, the only one who didn't go along with the cover-up was Admiral Moore, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and chief of naval operations. He stuck to his guns and said it was a deliberate thing. But none of them would discuss Operation Cyanide, the fact that it wasn't an Israeli deliberate attack. It was an American operation to sink that ship. I mean, it gets pretty ugly, you know. That's the reality of the thing. Nobody can talk about that, even these two characters yesterday on the radio or television program I was on.
Right. Now, didn't Lyman L. Lemnitzer put Admiral John S. McCain, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Navy, in Europe in charge, and then afterwards they promoted him to a four-star commanding position in February of 1967?
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Lemnitzer was, of course, the brains behind Operation North Woods and the Liberty attack, the Liberty Operation Cyanide. People said, well, yeah, North Woods was a plan, but it was never fulfilled. You know, there was never anything done under North Woods, like shooting down American airliners blaming
right.
it on Cuba.
But, well, because President Kennedy said, no way.
Yeah, you guys are crazy. But actually, Operation Cyanide was the North Woods plan. Exactly.
Yes.
This is a false flag deal, you know, formalized by the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Right. Right.
And that's exactly what happened in Operation Cyanide, the sinking of the Liberty. That was the plan. So,
and from what I understand, John McCain directed the operations from his office in London.
Admiral McCain, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was in charge of everything for Johnson. Now,
yes.
Johnson, this is the most vile criminal, I think, who has ever been in the White House. He should have been in prison. He barely escaped prison by the assassination of Kennedy. But he was controlled by Arthur Krim.
Right, Matilda's husband.
Right, Arthur Krim was the chairman of the Democrat Party Finance Committee. He was also the head of United Artists Studios in Los Angeles. And Matilda was his wife. Now, Matilda Krim was not Jewish, but she had married a Jewish terrorist, David Dannon.
Yeah, he was a Bulgarian Jew.
Yeah, and he was a member of the Irgun, the Menachem Begin terror group. And so she had distinguished herself as a courier and a spy for Irgun for
right.
many years.
She converted to Judaism.
Yeah, right. She was an Italian, I think, actually Italian or Swiss, Italian-Swiss, something like that. But,
yeah.
She was Johnson's mistress and controlled him through sex. And Arthur Krim, the husband, controlled Johnson through money. So he was kind of whipsawed by these two characters. It was so intense that, of course, Johnson came from Johnson City, Texas, and Arthur Krim bought a little ranchette near Johnson's home and built a house on it called Grace's House. And he installed Matilda. He installed Matilda in, it was called Matilda's House. And he installed his wife there so that she could service LBJ. And of course, he was an honored guest in room 303 in the White House of LBJ's, and he would visit her at nighttime. In fact, he was the first person she was the first person that he visited when the attack was announced. And she was giving him his orders. And so it was something like something out of a movie, and I've written a movie script about it because it's so entertaining, you know.
Right, and that movie script is available on your website.
Yep, called Cyanide, and it's all based on actually Peter Hounam's book, Operation Cyanide, which I mentioned yesterday in that television program, because Michael Santomaro, I'm not even sure what his, you know, reason for living is, but he said, I never heard of Operation Cyanide. Well, I said, I can't help that. I mean, there's a book by the BBC about it. You know?
Exactly. Just because they haven't heard about it doesn't mean that it didn't exist. Well,
yeah. Well, this is the most diabolical secret, I think, in Washington, that America and Israel sent the USS Liberty to be sunk. And I think it's the basis, because everything, you know, evil started happening after the Liberty attack.
Sure, a lot of stuff. I mean, in 1967, and then you move forward to other things, and then by the time you get to 1979, you have the President Carter's Commission on the Holocaust, chaired by Elie Wiesel, and amazing stuff in those years.
I think the Liberty scandal is the blackmail weapon, though, that Israel uses against America, because America has never been able to say no to Israel ever since that thing happened, and all Israel has to say is, well, hell, it was a joint operation.
Yes, and it certainly was.
Yeah, absolutely.
And blackmail is their forte. I mean, they're very good at this. They've been using this this tactic for a very long time. They used it against Woodrow Wilson with his letters to Mary Peck. I mean, they use blackmail. They get people in a position of, compromising position. And if they can do it to people, to individuals, well, certainly they can do it to whole nations.
Yep, that's where we are. And, of course, now that operation, I mean, we have to really kind of look at that thing and the failure it represented. It was a total disaster. I'm sure Johnson was beside himself with rage, because he did say, I'd rather they sink the goddamn thing than go against my friends. Now, I was about to say on that television show yesterday, because they were poo-pooing this idea, that when Johnson said that to Admiral Geis, because Geis had scrambled fighters not only to nuke Cairo and Alexandria, but to rescue the Liberty. The Saratoga and the America had tried to do that, and they were called back. And when Johnson finally told Geis to stop it, he said, I'd rather they sink it than embarrass my friends. Well, nobody knew at that point who was attacking. The guys on the Liberty had no idea who was attacking them. Geis had no idea, unless he was in on it, but he claims he wasn't. But Johnson knew. So that's the proof right there that it was a plan, that it was an operation.
Of course. I mean, that goes without saying. And there were other people that knew about it also. For instance, the person that said, McNamara is reported to have said, we are not going to war over a bunch of dead sailors.
Yeah.
And, that came up. So, and that is from the findings of the Independent Commission of Inquiry into the Israeli attack. So, I mean, there's plenty of records to indicate, to verify everything that you're saying, that it was a joint operation, that it had a particular reason, and it failed.
Now, there's a real irony here. I mean, a huge irony, because for years I was encouraged by my Russian friend Alexander to write this screenplay. And I thought, well, I don't know, you know, that's a pretty ambitious project. But then he said, I finally said, okay, I'll write it. He said, hey, you think it'd be possible to put something positive in there about Russia? I don't know. I mean, maybe. So I started investigating this thing, and I found out that the whole disaster was prevented by the Soviet Navy. the Liberty was being followed out of Gibraltar by the Russian destroyers, and it was ordered to stop following it when the Liberty sailed serenely right down into the war zone. The Russians said, no, you don't go that far, you stay back. And then, of course, Liberty was hit, and the Soviets were monitoring the whole thing. And when the Liberty started limping away from the kill zone towards Malta, the destroyer picked them up again and started following them. And they were, you know, these guys were shocked that this ship had been attacked. When they finally observed it, they said, "My God, you know, this thing has been, why is it still floating?" And nobody could understand it. But they tailed it. And they knew there was a submarine tailing it too, because apparently the plan was to sink the ship by the U.S. submarine, failing this inept behavior by Israel. But the Soviet destroyer seemed to understand this diabolical treachery, and the Soviets realized they were going to be blamed for this attack because they were sponsoring Egypt, and the Jewish plan was to use this deception to attack, or at least order the Soviet Navy out of the Mediterranean. And it was potentially World War III starting over this thing. But these maniacs in Washington and Israel, they didn't care. They're like these scientists saying, "Well, let's try it. Let's try it." And so really, the Soviet Navy saved not only the Liberty, but probably prevented us from going to a nuclear war, which was quite possible in 1967. So that was the irony. Our, you know, attacked by allies, defended and protected by the enemy.
Right. And there were people... And that is an amazing story. And your friend translated your screenplay, didn't he, into Russian?
Yeah, we were trying to get the Putin crowd to... I kept saying, you know, this could never be filmed anyplace but on the Caspian Sea, you know, with the protection of the Russians
right.
today.
Right.
So, I mean, I said, we could duplicate the Mediterranean and the Caspian or the Black Sea, right? He said, yeah. So, well, get your government to sponsor this movie, because it would destabilize the Washington-Tel Aviv axis. You know, if this movie ever comes out, the American people are going to be furious, because, I mean, I know how to write a screenplay. You know, there's no
right.
question. So we tried. He tried, but obviously it's not a simple thing. Politics are not always what you think they are.
Right. And you certainly do need the logistics to be right for this movie. I mean, it couldn't be done in some sort of studio for certain.
A friend of mine is the head of script development for 20th Century Fox. He asked to read it. Of course, his hair turned white when he read it, and I never heard any more from him again.
I'll bet. Oh, my goodness. And they destroyed, getting back to the USS Liberty, I mean, they didn't just destroy the ship or attempt to destroy the ship. They also went after the lifeboats. They destroyed the lifeboats. And when it was going back to Malta, it was tilting, what, by 11 degrees or something like that. I mean, this was horrible. And you said it was a total miracle that it was able to get back. And now you bring in this extra factor that they had a Russian ship that was there kind of to protect them back to Malta.
Yeah, they were being tailed by this submarine. Now, Joe Lentini, one of the veterans, one of the survivors, he was approached by a sailor who said he was on the Amberjack, the submarine that was tailing them, and which had taken photographs and movies of the attack. Of course, they were never able to find this guy again.
They probably killed him.
Probably so. The screenplay, you know, reveals a lot of the fascinating details. Like some of the guys were taken to Naval Hospital in Puerto Rico. I mean, they were scattered all over the world. They never saw each other again, and some were had to undergo psychiatric brainwashing. The hard cases, you know, who said that was a deliberate attack. What are you talking about? Well, they had to be treated psychiatrically.
Oh my! Kind of denazified, huh?
Yeah, I mean, they had to undergo brainwashing, and even electroshock therapy was used on them. So you know, it was a very, very bad thing that the U.S. Navy did. I mean, it's typical. You know, U.S. Navy is no better than the Army or the Air Force or the Marine Corps. They're all rotten organizations.
They are absolutely. Yeah, the torpedo boats, these Israeli torpedo boats, destroyed the lifeboats that the crew attempted to escape in. I mean, these people were, well, they were just a bunch of murderers.
I mean, this ship was supposed to sink, you know, with all hands, all 300 guys were supposed to go to Davy Jones' locker and be blamed, the whole thing blamed on Egypt. I mean, what America would have gladly gone to war against Egypt with that, you know, legend in place.
Of course. Isn't that what 9/11 was used for, to go to war against Iraq and Afghanistan? Sure they would.
9/11 was the exact same operation, only much more sophisticated. I mean, the Liberty thing should have worked. You know, it was a beautiful plan from the Jewish viewpoint. It was perfect. And somehow it failed. And just like 9/11 failed. I mean, it got us into wars, but it has created such hatred in this country, you know. And that's what these guys do. I mean, they're just going about their business, these Jews. They're just doing what they do.
And so for them, 9/11 was perfect. As Netanyahu said, 9/11 was a great benefit to Israel. And so for them, it was perfect. But for all the people who have perished, all of the millions in Iraq and Afghanistan who have suffered from the depleted uranium, from you know, actually dying, and I don't know how many of our troops have died, but... Yeah, it's perfect for them. And meanwhile, America is spending trillions of dollars in warfare that we have absolutely no business being in.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, I believe. The plan has always been to create this greater Israel. And that's what the Liberty incident was about. And that's what 9/11 was about. And to that extent, they have failed. And I guess they will always fail in that attempt.
I don't know. They're still working on it.
I know. They'll work on it for the rest of time, but I don't think it's ever going to work. There's something, you know, the Israelis, the Jews are a cursed people. They just can't get it right. Because my theory is Jews are allergic to work. You know, physical work. They cannot do real work. They have to get other people to do work.
And the fighting and the dying.
Yeah preferably. I mean, they can do financial stuff, you know, scams and things like that. But when it comes to actual work, they don't like that. So they like to do it by remote control. And they're lazy. They want to do it the easy way. But it never works for them because they just don't quite understand things. You know, they have this delusion of grandeur. The little Jewish tailor is certain that he can run an army. And so quite often he gets the chance to do it. But it never works out because he just doesn't understand the ways of work.
Right. Okay, so tell us what influence the McCains have had in concealing this operation. And some of the other people who are involved in this concealing it. I mean, there's I think Vin Weber and McCains. Who else have been involved?
Well, of course, the Jewish machine has been has been behind it, but Lyndon Johnson, he ordered McNamara to put the fear of God into these sailors and threaten them with whatever. I mean, that's probably the most astonishing aspect of this scandal is the fear that was instilled in these men when they realized the enormity of the crime against them. I mean, maybe some of them never did grasp the level of treachery by the U.S. government. But, I mean, forget Israel. Israel was just doing what the Navy wanted it to do, and the NSA and Johnson and the White House. I mean, the real treachery here is by the American government. And that's something that's very difficult for a Navy man, an Army man, to accept. It's just, I'm sure their minds just go into collapse, you know, in meltdown, when they think that they could be betrayed so utterly by their own government.
Now, Operation Cyanide, even after all this time, there's not a single reference to Operation Cyanide, despite the numerous Freedom of Information Act requests regarding the attack. I mean, nobody even mentions this. Now, those records are archived in the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library in Austin, Texas. And those records that pertain to the Liberty are stamped, and one is dated April 10th, 1967, are stamped secret eyes only. So, I mean, they were planning this. This happened on June 8th, but they were planning this, and there are records in that library that are dated April 10th, 1967.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it was apparently Matilda Krim, you know, was one of the main planners of this thing, because she kept telling her lover boy, Lyndon, to, you know, be strong, and this can still work, darling.
Yes.
You know, her plan, she wanted that ship sunk. She recommended, and Walt Rostov.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Recommended that the ship be sunk.
Now, he was a national security advisor, and there is a document from a meeting on April 7th, 1967, that he attended along with Ambassador Foy Kohler, K-O-H-L-E-R, who was a deputy undersecretary of state, Cyrus Vance, and Admiral Rufus Taylor, who was the CIA deputy chief. So this was an American operation with Israeli assistance.
That's the whole nexus of this thing. It was an American operation, and that just you know, like a blowtorch on military men's minds. They just can't grasp this concept too much.
Right. Well, they would have to. I mean, they're in a state of denial because if they accepted this, they would have to say, okay, what else has the U.S. government been lying to the American public about? Why have we been in all of these wars? I mean, you can understand why they would not want to consider this, and why people continue to cover it up, because it's easy to do, particularly if the same people who did the operation are the same people who are involved in the cover-up.
It's the equivalent, I guess, of your parents, you know, trying to kill you or torture you to death or something like that. The human mind is too fragile for this level of treachery and evil.
Right. Interesting. Now, are you familiar with Ephraim Evron, the minister of the Israeli embassy?
During that attack, you mean?
Yeah, because he was in Washington in 1967. And he thinks of Johnson as a hero.
Well, naturally.
Yeah. And this guy also visited Johnson at his Texas ranch, along with other people, Harry McPherson in fact, Harry McPherson was a special counsel in the White House, served as a link between Johnson and the country's Jewish population and represented their interests. So, I mean, Johnson basically sold out to the American Jews, and that is why they created this Operation Cyanide. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all of a continuation of, you know, killing Kennedy.
Oh, yeah. We got to factor that in, too, because Kennedy was totally against the nuclear plans of Israel and basically said no to two different prime ministers, right?
Yes, that's true. He infuriated David Ben-Gurion so thoroughly that Ben-Gurion resigned as prime minister, and then Levi Eshkol took over, and he was in charge when Kennedy was killed. But not only did he insist that Dimona be inspected, you know, the nuclear factory, but he also ordered his brother, the attorney general, to investigate the Jewish fundraising groups and ordered them to be listed as alien organizations, which would have wrecked their tax-exempt status for Jews to contribute to Israel. You know, somehow Jews get a tax exemption for giving money to Israel.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. So Bobby Kennedy was ordered by Jack to put an end to that. But before it could go into effect, he was killed.
Oh, my. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So Johnson, of course, was happy to do anything that Israel wanted. I mean, that up until then, it's quite interesting. There was not this obvious freeway of largesse going to Israel until Johnson took over. You know, Kennedy was quite hostile towards them and didn't care what anybody thought about his hostility. Eisenhower, who, of course, is a war criminal of all time, still was not afraid to say no to Israel and tell them to get out of Suez and that sort of thing in 56. But Johnson was probably the worst criminal in the history of the White House. And he was totally controlled by Arthur Krim and Matilda Krim and the other Jews around him. So everything changed then.
And it's kind of interesting that the Jewish people, including William Kristol, backed McCain in the 2000 presidential race. And so I wonder if that was sort of a payback for helping with the Operation Cyanide. I mean, it's, you know, you see these same people popping up in various positions of influence. And like the Admiral McCain, he did a really, really great job. So we're going to award his son for the job that the Admiral did. I mean, it's just amazing. Do you find that so?
I mean, that's John McCain is a real eight ball. He's been an eight ball all his life.
Yes.
His behavior as a pilot was so shockingly bad. You know, he was a smart aleck, and he was a guy that liked practical jokes, and he'd do these wet starts in front of the other pilots as they were getting ready to take off from the aircraft carrier, which means letting the fuel build up in the engine before you start it, and then it belches out this huge fireball and right into the nose of the guy behind you.
What a jerk.
Well, that's what I mean. He's an eight ball, troublemaker, a smart ass. So he did this, and the ordnance that was hanging on the wings of the jet behind him exploded and started this massive fire and explosion on the aircraft carrier. Got dozens of guys killed.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. And he alone was transferred to a different aircraft carrier after this disaster. He went to, the Ticonderoga or something. Then he got shot down by the North Vietnamese and went into the Hanoi Hilton. And, of course, the guys who were there with him don't have this charitable attitude towards him that everybody else does as a prisoner of war. They know that he immediately said that he was Admiral McCain's son and that he would cooperate in any way to avoid any more pain, because he had a couple of broken arms from his ejection, and he would do anything. And they apparently, according to some of the guys who were there, cooperated 100% with the North Vietnamese and said everything and anything that they wanted.
Right.
So I think, McCain, when approached by the families of the POWs and the missing, he said, no, it's done. They're, just forget them. When everybody knew that there were guys still alive, you know, back in the 80s.
Right.
And he would not cooperate. He would not help one bit. And, of course, the theory is, by some of his compatriots, was that he was blackmailed and he would do anything the North Vietnamese said at the time, and he kept protecting the North Vietnamese, or the Vietnamese, afterward.
Amazing. And he is supposed to be he is supposed to be a representative of the people. I mean, and then of course he married into the Arizona crime family, and that's how he basically got into the Senate. He came home, divorced his wife, who was ill, and then married into the family that had control of the liquor distribution company in Arizona and elsewhere, and had enough money thereafter to run for Congress, and he's been there ever since.
He's a very unpleasant character, for sure.
Yeah, another treasonous guy.
Yeah.
Wow. All righty. What else do we want to say about the USS Liberty? Have you read Phil Turney's book on that?
No, I have not. I have not had a chance to read it yet. Yeah, I'd already written my screenplay by the time it came out, so I was kind of thought it was a little late for more information, but I'm sure it's a good book.
Yeah, fabulous book. And he saw the planes. He gives a lot of testimony about it, and certainly his book tells what happened. And I'm grateful that he had the courage to write it. And he was threatened. He was threatened several times. Literally threatened. His life was threatened because he wrote this book, and he's speaking out against the Israelis. And interesting. Well, so you've done some really good articles. Well, all of your articles are very interesting, but you did one, a couple lately. You talked about the military answer, and let me just bring them up. Yeah, the best defense. And you were taught, what interested me in one of your articles was in women and how they should shoot from the hip. Instead of aiming as we usually see in the movies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of a shortcut, and I think it's an excellent training device because, pistols, revolvers, and rifles, of course, but shotguns, they have some recoil. But if you, when you're shooting pool, for example, you don't have to line up down the end of your pool cue and aim at the ball. You can have your head right over the ball and shoot pretty much from the hip when you're shooting pool. So just a matter of practice. So it's the same with guns, handguns. You hold it down by your waist right under you, and you can look at the target, and it's quite easy to bring the bullet onto the target, even shooting from the hip. And there's no recoil that you notice in front of your face, and you don't blink, you don't have to flinch or anything like that. So it gives the shooter, even an experienced shooter, a lot of people don't do this. Most people don't do it. They want to shoot what they call offhand, with looking down your arm, through the sights.
Right, that's the way I learned.
Well, sure. I mean, and to be very accurate, that's what you would do. But I don't like to start out that way because the gun does jump a little bit and the person might flinch a little bit. So to prevent that, just hold it down at your waist against your arm against your side and stabilize it that way and practice and see how easy it is to bring the bullets onto the target that way. It's quite, and it gives you a great feeling of self-confidence, and it makes you look very accomplished, you know, to somebody that you got the drop on. Because if you're standing there with your gun out in front of your face and your hand starts shaking a little bit or waving around, the person you're covering might get a little confidence from that, thinking, oh, I can have this person, you know. If I can get a little closer, if I can just get a little closer, I don't think he or she is going to squeeze that trigger off before I can grab it from her.
Huh.
So when you have it down at your waist, it changes the whole equation, and the person under who's being covered has no confidence at that point.
So, now, what kind of a gun would you recommend for a woman?
A snub-nose 38. I think this is the ideal gun, like a Smith & Wesson Chief Special or a stainless one or a Colt Agent or a Colt Detective Special, that kind of thing. The snub-nose 2-inch barrel is the ideal weapon for everybody. You know, I like a 45, but a 38 Special is a very respectable round. And you just don't have to think of it in terms of one bullet. You know, you got five of them or six of them in these revolvers. And they're very reliable, they're very safe. You can shoot them double action, meaning you can just pull the trigger and make it go. Or you can pull the hammer back and shoot it single action. But this is the ideal weapon for a woman.
Okay. And I totally believe that people have the right and should protect themselves by whatever means they can.
Absolutely. You know, there are no rules when it comes to self-defense. You've got to defend yourself. You've got to win. So that's the whole idea here. And don't give any mercy to anybody that's threatening you.
Right.
And any mercy, especially from the government killers. That's you know, criminals, as I said in my little article, criminals can be bluffed. You can do with them as you please. You can turn them over to the cops or whatever you want to do with them. I mean, it's up to you. But when it comes to government killers, the guys that we're going to be confronted with from here on out, there could be no mercy shown to these guys because they have no mercy in them. And you can't capture them. What are you going to do with them? If you can't capture a killer, you have to kill him. There's just no other way.
Now, do you believe that the government would use foreign troops or foreign individuals to impose martial law?
Well, that's been the you know, that's been the threat, bringing all these guys in from Germany and Russia and all these United Nations guys. That's what essentially the question in the military's mind is, even amongst their own people. You know, the famous 45 questions, the questionnaire that was devised at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey back in 94, asked American soldiers and Marines, the first 43 or 44 questions had to do with would you accept orders from foreigners? Say United Nations had taken over and you were under United Nations officers, would you accept them as your leaders? Of course, the famous or the infamous 45th question was, the Second Amendment has been declared null and void. Americans cling to it and refuse to give up their weapons. Would you fire on American citizens to take their weapons away from them, if so ordered? And I think 40-some-odd% said, yeah, we would. So.
Oh, my. Now, do you have those 45 questions somewhere on your website?
you can search. I mean, it's a very searchable thing. I don't know if I have it in my, I probably have it in one of my articles, but the actual 45, I mean, the only one I really cared about was number 45. So, but the 45 questions are online. You can find them easily.
Okay. And that was put out by who created that?
That was done by a professor at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, in 1994.
Okay.
And it was first put to Marines, I think, at 29 Palms Marine Base, and then the Army. I mean, it was circulated throughout the armed forces.
Amazing. But it has not been circulated to the mainstream media.
It did come out, you know, in 94. It was published. But now, of course, it's online and it's easy to find.
Okay. All righty. Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. And I appreciate you sharing your information with us. And grateful that you have the courage to do that. You say a lot of, as you say, you talk about a lot of controversial things. And I think that some of these things do need to be talked about. And as you say, J. B. Campbell, extremism online. You say some extreme things. Now, I noticed yesterday that they announced you as being from Veterans Today.
Yeah. I told them months ago that I'm not with Veterans Today anymore. I guess they didn't get the memo.
Yeah.
I think they like the idea. It gives me some kind of legitimacy.
Credibility?
If they saw J.B. Campbell extremismonline.com, they'd probably not be so happy to have me on their show.
But Veterans Today they use that to give you credibility?
I think it, you know, gives them credibility. They've got some character from a quasi-official sounding group. I mean, I'm not associated with Veterans Today and have not been for over a year.
Right.
So, I mean, I had to do my own thing. I didn't want to be under anybody's control. And they have the ultimate power to censor something if they didn't like it. So I didn't like that. I had to be my own man.
I can appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, thank you so much, Bruce, and let's do this again really soon.
Okay, Deanna.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.